House Resources Committee to order. This is House and the House Special Committee on Oil and Gas. Currently in attendance, we have Representative Crawford, Elkins, Olson, and Vice Chair Resources Ramirez. In the Senate, we have Senator Elton and myself, Senator Wagner. We're joined now by Representative Gatto. There will be other people coming in a while. They're tied up in other meetings, leadership meetings and everything. So I'm going to turn over the chairmanship of this committee to Representative Ramirez and do so at this time. So, Jay.
Thank you very much, Senator Wagner. We want to get started right away. This is a terrific opportunity. Thank you. It's a terrific opportunity because potentially there's so much gas in the Nenana Basin. Representative Young came to visit with the legislature last week, he was very spirited in his discussion about the opportunities for oil and gas exploration in the Nenana Basin. And we were pleased to tell him, Senator Wagner and I were pleased to share with him that we had planned this overview and had invited all of the relevant players, and we think that terrific opportunity is waiting in the Nenana Basin, and that all the people and all of the parts of the puzzle to make it happen are very likely in this room right now when it comes to exploration and people that can build a pipe and people that can operate a pipe and people that can build the homes that have the natural gas requirement. And the right-of-ways are already there, and it's a terrific opportunity to bring gas to the interior and potentially to remedy some of the supply problems that exist down in the Cook Inlet region. So with that, I think we're going to go to our first presenter with Index Resources, Bob Mason. Bob, can you join us, please? If you just state your name for the record and who you're with, and give us a brief overview, and then get her going.
Okay, my name's Bob Mason. I'm Vice President of Exploration for the Northern Division for Andex Resources. Have been in the oil and gas business since 1972.
Bob, we could have you sit down and do microphone will pick you
down
up.
Be, oh, sorry. Okay.
Down there would be best. Yeah.
I right apologize. Here.
Is this okay here? Or here?
It'd be best.
Sorry.
Are you afraid to turn your back to all those people?
Oh, not at all. Okay, let me start again very briefly. My name is Bob Mason. I'm Vice President of Exploration for the Northern Division for Andex Resources. I'm a geologist. I started in the industry, in the oil and gas industry, in 1972 with Shell Oil Company and left Shell in 79. Worked for a number of oil and gas companies, began working with Andex in 1999, and I've been handling all of the technical details on our Alaska project in the Nenana Basin. What I'd like to do is go ahead, I think I got to drive the computer here, is what I'm going to do is, let's see, open up the PowerPoint. And I don't know if it's possible to turn off some of the lights against the wall. I don't know how well some of this stuff is going to... There we go. Okay. How well is some of you can see some of this stuff. But basically what I'm going to do is give you an overview of the project. I'm going to tell you where the project is, why we're there, what it is we're doing, when we're going to do it, and at the end, I'm going to discuss a little bit why we think that the Nenana Basin is potentially a very, very strategic source for a very much needed gas resource for the state of Alaska. At this time, I want to acknowledge the partnership itself. Andex Resources is the operator, but we've got three Alaska companies, Usabelli Energy, which is a subsidiary of Usabelli Coal, Doyon Limited and Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, which are two of the Alaska Native corporations. And together, these three Alaska companies bring a lot of operational experience in the state to bear on the project, and that's going to be very, very important as we move through in the operational phase. Now, I know that a lot of you in this room, all of you in this room, are intimately familiar with the geography of Alaska. However, I find it very, very helpful to refer to location maps as I move through a presentation just to remind people of where we're at. This is a regional map of the state, and the important features to note, of course, are the producing complex that's up on the north slope, the TAPS line that comes down through Fairbanks and winds up in Valdez, and this green line is very, very critical to our project. It's the Parks Highway Alaska Railroad that connects Fairbanks and Anchorage. The Nanana Basin is shown in this yellow outline, and the center of that basin is about 50 miles west of Fairbanks. This is a shaded relief map of the southern part of the state, and so is those same features. Here's the TAPS line, there's the city of Fairbanks, the port of Valdez, Anchorage, and the Parks Highway Alaska Railroad comes right up along the Susitna Basin, goes through that topographic low through the Alaska Range, comes up right along the east edge of the Nanana Basin, and winds up in Fairbanks. Now, the next map I'm going to show you is a geographic map, topographic map, that's a blow-up of this area right here. This is the city of Fairbanks. Here's the Tanana River, which comes into the Nanana Basin, which is this large area proper here. The red outline that you see is our exploration license area. The village of Nanana is located right here. And one of the most critical factors that made us decide to move forward with an exploration project in this area is the presence of the Alaska Railroad and the Parks Highway that come up right along the east side of this basin. It's very critical because this transportation infrastructure provides us with access both into the basin and into our potential energy markets, which consist of three components. First of all, of course, the nearby energy component here, energy market in Fairbanks. And then as you go to the south, if the reserve size is large enough here, we could actually be providing much needed energy reserves for the Anchorage area. And ultimately, when the new gas pipeline comes down from the North Slope, it'll come right along the TAPS line by Fairbanks. And obviously, again, if the reserve potential size is big enough, we'll have the opportunity to produce energy into that open access line. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, I'm a geologist. And I'm pretty sure that most people in this room are going to be very, very familiar with any of the terms that I use, but geologists have got an alphabet. And every once in a while, I might toss something out that people don't understand. And if I do, just go ahead and ask the question, and I'll explain it. There's a couple of things that I want to point out on this shaded relief map that are very, very generic to the discussion. First of all, of course, there's the location of the Nanana Basin, and as you can see, the Nanana Basin is one of a whole series of low areas that are developed within the Alaskan interior. And these are called interior basins. And these basins began forming about 64 million years ago in a period of time that geologists refer to as the tertiary. So beginning in the earliest tertiary, at least in the earliest tertiary, these basins began to form. Now, while these basins were forming, there were also basins that were forming along the margin of Alaska, and Cook Inlet is one of the largest of these. The driving engine behind the formation of all these basins are these regional faults. The Caltag Fault, located right there, the Iditarod Fault, located right there, the Farwell-Denali Fault, and the Castle Mountain Fault, located right down here. It's movement along those faults that has created these basins. That movement has gone on all through the tertiary. It's going on today, as a matter of fact. These faults are loci of earthquakes, indicating that they're still active. And while these basins were being deposited, they were being infilled by non-marine sedimentary rocks. We know they're non-marine because they contain very thick, widespread coals. Coals don't form out here in the ocean. Coals form on land. So we know that all of these basins were infilled with these coal-bearing tertiary rocks. This is a geologic map of the southern part of the state. There's Fairbanks, there's Anchorage, there's those faults that I just talked about. There's the Cook Inlet, and you see the relationship of the Cook Inlet to the Nanana Basin. Now, what I'm going to do next is I'm going to talk very briefly about the Cook Inlet itself and tell you why that thing produces oil and gas. And then I'm going to jump up to the Nanana Basin and discuss some of the similarities and some of the differences. This map shows the location of the oil and gas fields in the Cook Inlet. Again, for reference, there's the city of Anchorage right there. The village of Kenai is located right here. The red areas that you see are the large gas fields in the Cook Inlet. The green areas are the oil fields. Okay, now geologists name rocks like people name babies. So don't worry about all the names. When they're similar enough, you group them into a family that we call the Kenai group south of the Alaska Range. The Kenai group contains all of the oil and gas in the Cook Inlet. It produces oil and gas that's produced by temperature and pressure in the basal part of the Kenai group, and it produces very, very large amounts of gas that are actually produced by biological processes, by bacterial action in the upper part of the Kenai group. And both of these processes have produced very, very prolific large volumes of hydrocarbons. The thermogenic hydrocarbons, the stuff produced by high temperature and pressure at the basal part of the Kenai group, has produced over a billion barrels of oil and I believe a little bit over 1 to 1.5 trillion cubic feet of gas. The upper part of the Kenai group, where all that biogenic gas comes from, has produced a little over 5 trillion cubic feet of gas. So it's a very, very large volume of hydrocarbons. The Kenai group itself has produced a little over 6 trillion cubic feet of gas and a billion barrels of oil. So it's a very, very prolific system. This is a map that shows the thickness of those tertiary coals that make, those tertiary non-marine sediments that contain coals that make up the Kenai group. Again, for reference, there's Anchorage, there's Kenai. And what this map shows is a couple of things. Number one, those red lines show areas where the tertiary gets very thick. It starts from zero edge right there and there, and it gets up over 20,000 feet thick just north of Kenai. So this is a very, very thick sedimentary section. The other thing that this map shows is that the Cook Inlet's an asymmetric basin. It's got a real steep east side. It's got a much gentler west side. It's also got a whole series of folds, areas where those rocks are bent. And its closures on those folds where all of the oil and gas fields are. And the red dots that I've got in this map show the largest gas fields in the Cook Inlet. There's the Kenai gas field, the North Cook Inlet gas field, the Beluga River gas field, and the gas associated with the big Trading Bay MacArthur River complex. Now, if you take a look at this line right here that we call a cross-section, it's going to show you what the Cook Inlet looks like in the subsurface. Cook Inlet, like I said, is an asymmetric basin. It's got a real steep east side, a much gentler west side, and that's where the tertiary is real thin. And all these colored, all of this color here, by the way, is the tertiary. That's Kenai group. There's the area where the Kenai gets over 20,000 feet thick. There's those folds, and there's the closures on top of those folds. The red are the gas fields, and the green are the oil fields. Okay, now what I want to do, that's a very brief overview of the Cook Inlet. It's on the basin margin, and we're going to jump up to the Nanana Basin, which is a basin interior basin. But as you'll see, there's a lot of similarities and differences. A lot of hydrocarbons have been produced down here from these tertiary rocks, and those hydrocarbons, of course, have supported the greater Anchorage metropolitan area, both industry and gas been used for home heating, ever since the late 50s, early 60s, when a lot of these things were developed. Okay, now let's jump up to the Nanana Basin. Okay, there's the dog breakfast of names for the tertiary up on the up north of the Alaska Range. But again, these are all very similar rocks. They're these tertiary, coal-bearing, non-marine rocks. And north of the Alaska Range, we call them the Usabelli Group. South of the Alaska Range, we call them the Kenai Group. The important thing is they're equivalent to each other. So the Nanana Basin contains the very same kinds of rocks that the Cook Inlet contains. That's the main point behind this slide. And the Usabelli group is already very economically significant to the state. All of the actively mined coals that Usabelli Coal Company mines comes from the Sintrana Formation. Now this is a map of the Nanana Basin, and that blue outline is the same as the yellow outline that I've shown on those previous maps. The areas in red are where the tertiary is real thin, and the areas where you see the yellow that's where the tertiary is real thick. So if you take a look at this, you see the shape of the basin. Here's the area where the tertiary is thick, there's where it's thin. You see that it's got a real steep east side, just like the Cook Inlet. There's the area in the Nanana Basin where the tertiary is real thick. It hugs the east side, just like the Cook Inlet does. And there's that very gentle west side. Now, the next thing I'm going to do is show you a diagrammatic cross-section of the Nanana Basin that goes east-west, just like that cross-section I showed you in the Cook Inlet. There's the east side where the tertiary is real thin, and there's that real steep east side as you go into the basin, and all of this sediment in here is tertiary sediments, these tertiary non-marine coal-bearing sediments. And our best estimate is they get in excess of 20,000 feet thick in the deepest part of the basin. Then they thin as you go to the west side. Again, very similar to what you see in the Cook Inlet. Now, this map also shows you a couple other things. First of all, there's the location of the first well that was drilled in the basin. It was drilled on the west side of the basin by Unocal in 1961. And they encountered about 2,800 feet of very thin tertiary coal-bearing section before they went into real hard, dense basement rocks. And that well tested that particular feature right there. Well, nothing was done in the basin for the next 20 years. In 1981, Shell came in and acquired 230 miles of seismic data in this part of the basin, and in 1982, ARCO acquired 115 miles in the same part of the basin, and in 1984, ARCO drilled the Totec Hills number one well on the south side of the basin. The tertiary there was about 3,000 feet thick, but ARCO acquired a tremendous amount of data on the tertiary in that well. And when you take a look at all of the information that's available in that well and combine that with all of the information that's been published by the USGS, by the state, and by various academic institutions on all of the outcrops on the south part of the basin, you have a tremendous data set. And what that data set says is that there's some significant potential in the Nanana Basin. So when you take a look at all of the data that's available, you've got all of the outcrop information, you've got the subsurface information from those two wells, and then what Andex did is we integrated this information with all of the seismic that Shell and ARCO shot. We purchased and reprocessed all of that data. So we integrated this entire data set. And I can tell you right now that that is a very high quality data set. This is excellent information. And as a matter of fact, if this information had existed in any basin in the lower 48 states, anywhere, industry would have evaluated this basin, would have drilled the critical evaluation wells years ago. But because of where the Nanana Basin is located, industry took a look at this thing, recognized that it's probably a gas-prone basin, and back in the early 80s, gas in the interior of Alaska, economically it wasn't worth pursuing. Well, that's then, this is now. What that data set shows is that, first of all, the Nanana Basin contains real thick sections of very fine grain rock that has a high content of organic matter in it. And if you subject that organic matter to high enough temperatures and pressures, you can convert it to oil and gas. So it has very, very widespread thick source rocks. As a matter of fact, these are some of the thickest and richest source rocks that I've ever worked with. Furthermore, it also contains potential containers that can hold oil and gas. And these reservoirs are also very thick and widespread. It also contains rocks that are very, very tight, and they act as seals. And they're present both above and below those potential reservoir rocks, so they can act as containers that can hold potential hydrocarbons in. The seismic shows that potential traps exist and that the basin is deep enough such that you could take those source rocks and bury them deep enough and subject them to high enough temperatures and pressures that you could generate significant volumes of hydrocarbons. In other words, what I've just told you is that the Nanana Basin contains a potential hydrocarbon system. And when you take a look at this data any way that you want, you come to that same conclusion, that this basin has got a lot of potential and it needs to be tested. When you combine the fact that you've got a potential hydrocarbon system with the fact that you have that accessibility associated with the nearby transportation infrastructure that provides you with the three market components that we recognize, namely the potential energy market in Fairbanks, the potential energy market in Anchorage, and ultimately the potential energy market provided by the pipeline coming down from the North Slope. What Andex then committed to do was apply to the state for an exploration license. That license was issued in October of 2002. It comprises a little over 480,000 acres, 750 square miles. We have 4 years remaining on the primary term, and we have the option to convert that acreage to leases that have another 7 year term. This provides us with the time that we will need to evaluate and develop this basin if it's successful. In association with the issuance of the exploration license, we committed to spend $2.5 million in exploration, in new exploration work in the basin. Well, this is the timeline where we're at right now. That's when the license was issued, in October of 2002. A week ago yesterday, we completed a 215-mile proprietary seismic program in the basin, and we will be in the process now of evaluating that new data. And what our intent is, depending on what we see from that evaluation, if we come up with drillable prospects, then we will go to our partners, to Isabella Energy, Doyon, and ASRC, and attempt to get them to agree to an exploration drilling program in the basin. And we intend, if we get to that stage, we intend to begin drilling in the Nanana Basin in 2006. This will be the next winter's drilling season. And if we are successful there, we could be in the development phase in late 2006, early 2007, and depending on the results that we see here, we could actually be negotiating for and then building a pipeline into the Fairbanks area such that we could be at first sales in late 2008. Now, what I want to conclude my presentation with is to emphasize two things. Number one, how strategic the Nanana Basin is located geographically. That was absolutely critical to our decision to go forward with an exploration program in this very, very high-risk area. That transportation infrastructure, as I mentioned, gives us accessibility. And we're on a fast track to evaluate this basin in a very, very timely manner. If we are successful and find sufficient reserves, by 2008, we could have pipeline infrastructure built from the Nanana Basin into Fairbanks. If the reserve base is large enough, we could actually be supplying reserves, much needed new reserves down to Anchorage, and be building a pipeline from the Nanana Basin down along the Parks Highway, Alaska Railroad right-of-way into Anchorage. Now, the critical thing about that is our timeline. Like I say, by 2008, we could be at first sales into Fairbanks. Well, there's been a lot of discussion on the timing of the gas pipeline coming down from the North Slope. Regardless of when that happens, when that pipeline does come down, it's going to be coming down near the north end of the basin and down into Fairbanks. By the time that pipeline shows up, given our timeline and if we are successful, pipeline infrastructure could already exist, all the way from Fairbanks down to Anchorage. In other words, your spur line could already be built. Now with that, I'd like to go ahead and conclude the presentation. One other thing that I want to emphasize, of course, is we, in the process of putting this partnership together, you know, we talked with a lot of people in industry and that sort about the project. And one of the things that I want to emphasize is that while we see tremendous potential in here, and we're fairly typical of the exploration business, Andex is a small company. It's typically the small companies that are out there taking the big risks when you do something like this. The important thing to emphasize is that while I believe that this basin has got a lot of potential, and given the database that I see, there's absolutely nothing that says that that can't work. The thing I want to emphasize is this is a very high-risk exploration project. We think that it's got enough merit to go ahead and proceed on this thing, and that's exactly what we're doing. And like I say, if successful, if this very high-risk project is successful, this is a very, very, could provide a very, very strategic new resource for the interior and for the metropolitan area. And with that, I'd like to go ahead and complete my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Mason, and we appreciate that excellent presentation. Before we take a couple of questions for you, I'd like to recognize that we are joined by Vice Chair of Resources, Senator Seekins, Chairman Samuels from House Resources, Chairman Coring from Oil and Gas. Representative Guttenberg has been with us since the beginning. Representative Dotto has joined us, as has Representative Ledoux. Are there any questions for Mr. Mason while we have him at the table? Or should we proceed to our next? Thank you very much, Mr. Mason. Next, we're going to have Bob Swenson. He's here with Sean Parnell. Mr. Parnell is the Deputy Director of Oil and Gas. Bob Swenson is Deputy Director of DGGS, and I think you're going to go over some of the geology from the state's perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Sean Parnell, Deputy Director, Division of Oil and Gas. This is Bob Swenson. I'm going to let Mr. Swenson handle this. It's typically a DGGS function to deal with geology. I'm happy to help with any oil and gas questions that go beyond that, though.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chairman Ramirez, Chairman Wagner. I appreciate the opportunity to present to you folks today. And I want to thank Bob Mason. Many of the slides that I have here today are related to the geology within the Nanana Basin and the surrounding southeast part of Alaska. So although I know all of you would love to hear another 30 minutes of geologic jargon, I will probably be skipping through a few slides that have already been covered, and we'll get down to some of the more important parts from the standpoint of the state. I'm presenting here today for Mark Myers. He apologizes he could not make it today's in negotiations on the gas line. And what we'd like to cover today is oil and gas activities in the Nanana Basin and importance to the state. Again, this is a map very similar to what Bob showed. The important points here, and I'll just get you oriented, the Nanana Basin located here, the town of Nanana, Fairbanks located here. The red lines that you see on the slide here are the pipeline corridor study area. The important part of this talk here is to present that the Nanana Basin, of all the interior basins that were talked about in the previous talk, the Nanana Basin clearly has the majority of the subsurface information, and that's very, very critical for an exploration program to move forward is what we understand in the subsurface. We can map surface areas, but the subsurface information is very important. In these small blocks here, what you see is the USGS assessment of the oil, the gas potential in these basins. Yukon Flats has a potential of about 5.46 TCF. In here, we're looking at 0.17 TCF in the Kandik Basin. The Nanana Basin here really does have the majority of the data, given the size, the current seismic data, as well as the wells that were drilled. And so exploration in this basin is very important for us to understand what the tertiary basins do contain as far as exploration and gas potential. I'll very quickly go through these. As was presented, the Andex Resources holds a 7-year exploration license for 482,000 acres with a $2.5 million work commitment. This license expires in 2009. The important thing of these exploration licenses is to provide the exploration companies with a incentive to go into these areas where we have very, very limited data, collect that data, and then go to lease following that. So it's a very good incentive to get exploration going in these basins. Again, Bob talked a lot about the tertiary stratigraphy in there, and I won't go into any detail on that. But we do recognize within the state that there is good potential for both coal bed methane and conventional natural gas. There are good reservoir rocks associated with the thick coal seams. There's also a deep possibility for deep source and reservoir rocks for conventional thermogenic gas. And the tertiary sedimentary section is time equivalent to the Cook Inlet, and everyone in the committee understands the importance of the Cook Inlet in the gas picture in Alaska. The potential for oil in these basins is relatively low, unlike the Cook Inlet, where we have a deeper source rock beneath this tertiary fill. None of the interior basins have that potential, so any oil potential would have to come from within that tertiary stratigraphy, and it has not been identified to date. So the oil potential in these basins is relatively low. And finally, the limited GNG data in these basins is a critical aspect to this. All of these basins are either not explored at all or very, very underexplored. In the Nanana Basin, where we do have that primary data, I won't go through these wells, Bob went through those, but we have two wells and an existing 2D seismic grid, as well as some gravity information. This map just shows the license area, and Bob did talk about sounds like that they've completed that seismic survey, and that will be critical for them to go into the next phase of and possibly go to lease. This just shows the outline of that basin. Again, very thick tertiary section, thicker in the northern part, up to 15,000 feet and 10,000 feet in the southern part of the basin. You can see the wells that were drilled were actually on the edges of the basin and never did test that deeper portion. This slide is along the uplift of that same tertiary section near the Alaska Range to the south, and it does point out two important things. It shows the very, very thick coal seams that are in the subsurface under the basin, as well as that lighter colored rock, which would be a reservoir rock in a trapping situation. And that points out that one of the critical risks here is a trap, and a trap is nearly always identified through seismic acquisition and interpretation. This is again the cross section that was showed earlier, and I'll skip over that. And here is the area that was just recently shot with 2D data that they will be using for their prospecting. This is my last slide here, and I apologize for it. It's a bit complicated here, but just if you'll take a look at this upper portion of the spreadsheet here in the first two columns, this just shows in the Fairbanks area what the current residential and commercial use is in 2000 as well as in 2004, and it shows an increase of 0.1 or 100 million cubic feet per year to 0.5 or 500 million cubic feet per year in those 4 years. And then extrapolates out into 2009 and 2020, both the high and low side, and an increase using those numbers and that increase, it assumes that there's a 50% increase or 50% usage of the gas by Fairbanks residents. Also in the future, depending on exploration success, of course, and as Bob pointed out, this is a very risky venture in areas where we have this limited data. You have the possibility of power generation with 6.5 BCF per year and up into 2020 of up to 12 to 27 BCF per year, depending on what industry comes into the area. Industrial use, of course, and there's a list of industrial possibilities in the lower part of the slide. You could get up to 300 BCF a year, but most likely in a medium case, about 30 BCF per year used. So that gives you totals here by 2009 of 9.6 BCF and 48.5 to 330 BCF per year from the Nanana Basin, again, depending totally on that expiration. And I will conclude there and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Bob. Are there any questions for Bob?
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bob. Next, I have Mitch Usabelli with Usabelli Energy. And Mitch, if you could just come up here and give us an overview of the role of Usabelli Energy.
Hello, thank you, Representative. I'm Mitch Usabelli, manager of Usabelli Energy, which is the Usabelli entity in the Usabelli family of businesses that chose to invest in this project with Andex Resources. I did speak with representatives from both Doyon and Arc Slope Regional Corporation prior to coming, and that while they had made every effort and plans to come here, they apologized for not being able to arrive today due to some mechanical delays and conflicts. I didn't prepare any formal comments or presentations. We left that to Bob and Andex, who is the operator of the project. But I would like to say, obviously, we're very enthusiastic about this project and this opportunity to diversify our interests in the interior and natural resource holdings, as well as the opportunity to potentially diversify an energy source in the interior of Alaska, you know, beyond the coal operations that we currently have. I also am very excited about working with Andex and the oil and gas experience that they bring to the table as an operator on this, and we believe there's a great synergy between our company and our Alaskan experience and Doyon and Arctic Slopes experience with Andex as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Yusbeli. I know it's a little impromptu, but Tom Dodds, could you just come up and give us a background a little bit as to Andex, so we can understand the nature of the investment group and how Andex is approaching this project, please?
Good afternoon. Thanks for inviting us up. My name's Tom Dodds. I'm the president and CEO of Andex, headquartered in Houston, Texas. Bob Mason is our Northern Division Vice President, located in Denver. Andex is a privately owned company. We're owned basically by two family groups, one in New York, one currently located in Florida and Colorado. The founders of Andex have been in the oil and gas business going back to the 1950s. Irving Wolf of the Wolf family started several oil and gas companies throughout his early career. An Exco Oil Company was sold to LL&E back in 1986. We were about a $1 billion company. I've been associated with Mr. Wolf and his family operation since 1977. Ran the Denver division, which was the largest division in the company, for 10 years after the sale to Louisiana Land and Exploration. Moved back to Houston and joined Mr. Wolf, and we had family partnerships of Andex Partners. We rolled the assets of Andex Partners in with a cash contribution by another member of our current company ownership and formed Andex Resources, LLC. I was one of the founding employees of Andex Resources, LLC. We have a significant base of operations in Wyoming, Texas, Louisiana, the Gulf of Mexico, Mississippi, small operations in Oklahoma, Illinois, and Michigan. We have a small subsidiary company that conducts activity in Canada. So we pretty much cover the continental United States and Canada with our exploration efforts. We feel that the Nana Basin is potentially a very large gas and associated oil complex that has great potential. However, it's extremely high risk, and it's extremely expensive to operate in Alaska, as you're all very much aware of. We currently feel we're under about a 2.5 months a year drilling season to conduct operations in the basin. We barely finished our seismic operations this year. The weather, as you know, was abnormally warm. While we did have some temperatures as low as 40 degrees, we had temperatures as high as 50 degrees in the last 30 days up in the Nanana Basin that made operations tenuous. But we were fortunate and caught another cold snap and were able to finish everything last Wednesday. We basically have 10.5 months a year to plan for a month and a half or 2.5 months of drilling operations. So we've got a lot of logistics to bring together, rigs, equipment, materials, permitting of wells. We'll start working with the various departments of the state of Alaska within the next 30 to 40 days on trying to begin the formal process of general area of permitting while we're finishing up the evaluation of the seismic we just finished and are determining where we hope our potential drill sites will be.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dodds. And then do we have Jim Mary on the line with Doyon up in Fairbanks? Jim, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Jim, can you give us a little bit of background from our conversation we had last week as to what Doyon's role is in this project, along with Andex and Yusbeli Energy, please?
Doyon's role in this project, I think we'd like to take a little bit of credit for kickstarting it, I think, because Doyon, together with the Togatili Corporation, which is an Anana Village Corporation, own about 36,000 acres in the heart of the basin. We started looking at the area a number of years ago, acquiring all of the available data, including the ARCO data sets, and then tried to went around the industry to try to attract some interest, and met up with the Andex folks. We liked each other, and we've been working together for several years, put together a lease with them for the Doyon lands, and have worked with them, assisting them to secure the exploration license on the adjacent state lands. And we've also decided, which is a bit unusual for Doyon, generally we take a more passive, just a lessor of land role in minerals and oil and gas exploration, but our board liked this project enough that we decided to actually invest hard cash in it as well. We put up not just land, but a fair amount of money. And we are very enthusiastic about things that could happen on state lands and hopefully the adjacent Doyon Tocotili lands as well.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Mary? Great. Jim, if you'll just stay on the line with us for a little bit. And I think we're now going to have NSTAR give a presentation on how we'd go about building a pipe and connecting the gas to the users. And if it's a PowerPoint, if somebody could hit the lights again, please, I'd sure be appreciative.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chairman Remmers, Chairman Wagner. My name is Tony Izzo. I'm the president of NSTAR Natural Gas Company, and to my right is John Lau. John has been with NSTAR in charge of our transmission operations, engineering, constructing our pipelines for more than 15 years, and will be doing part of the presentation in a few moments. I'll kick it off with a little bit about who we are, and our obviously two driving principles we think are critical are taking care of customers, keeping costs down. NSTAR has done this for going on 45 years, established in 1961. We currently serve almost half the state's population. The number of meters is 118,000, but when you factor the number of residents per dwelling, you come up with that number north of 300,000. In terms of size of the company, our transmission and distribution, we have 3,000 miles of natural gas pipeline that have been constructed over the last 40 years. It's a direct impact of about $170 million per year in capital expenditures, payroll, overheads, etc. We do this very efficiently with 167 full-time employees, and during probably 6 months of the year, 5-6 months of the year during the construction season, that'll swell by about 50 to 60 additional seasonal employees. We understand that we're the largest energy utility or distribution company in the state, and in terms of growth, we're about twice the national average for a natural gas distribution company. And that equates to over 3,500 customers added to the system net growth in 2004. Our transmission pipeline arm of NSTAR Natural Gas is called Alaska Pipeline Company. APC has been around 45 years. We've constructed and operated over 450 miles of high-pressure transmission pipeline, 2,600 miles of distribution. This represents 75% of all the transmission pipeline in the state right now for natural gas, 100% of the distribution. Our expertise is something, of course, that's core to us in-house, but we also make it available to other entities in the business in our region, and that is in the areas of engineering, environmental, permitting, construction, and construction management. A recent survey that was taken, we thought it was interesting that to see how we were viewed by the public, and the perception was very positive, with 74% positive. Good. In terms of size of utilities, as you look around the state, you can see us on the left at 118,000 meters if we're counting meters. This is the comparison Chugatz Electric would be the second largest at 69,000, and it just moves across with Matanuska Electric, Municipal Light and Power, Golden Valley, and Homer Electric on the right at 26,500. A slide that I think many are familiar with, it's something we live with, it's in the forefront of our thoughts every day, and that is the amount of gas, the supply in the Cook Inlet, and the projected and forecast production as we go forward. What we're looking at here are years across the bottom, this being 2005, the vertical line. The various colors in here are the various producing fields and the projected availability of supply or production going forward. So we see this cliff here, which is very much a concern to us as a company that distributes gas to almost half the state's residents. In terms of trends of usage, again, this is just being Cook Inlet. On the bottom, you'll see red here. This goes back to 1970 on the all the way to the left. 2005 is this point here to the right. So in terms of the trend, you can see slow growth in natural gas distribution for NSTAR. The green is power generation. Blue is LNG, and then ammonia urea up at the top. This slide was put by the Department of Energy in a supply and demand study that was concluded and published last summer, 2004. Again, across the bottom, the horizontal axis, these are years. We start out with about 2004 being this first bar right here. These are volumes of gas demand on the vertical axis, this being Agrium right here. And the DOE put this together on their own with input from various aspects of the industry. They felt that Agrium would be finished at the end of 2005, which is why you just see the 2 years there. They show LNG use in blue, and you'll see in 2009 just a little bit left there, and their assumption was that the license would not be extended past that point. They took information from the power companies, NOMP, Chugach, and you'll see their expected requirements going forward, and then NSTAR's on the bottom in red. The next thing that they did was they overlaid the information that was available from DNR, and they did some of their own analysis. Remember the previous slide I referred to the cliff? Here's that line here, and this is the production that is projected. And in the different colors, we've got demand. So the first thing that comes to our attention is, where does it intersect? For the first time here, which is 2012, the amount of gas needed to meet the demand for power generation and home heating is more than the supply available. And it's important to point out that this assumes that nothing new is discovered, that everything stays the same as it is known today. The next thing that we thought of is distributors, power generators, the group of us that were working with the Department of Energy is, gee, there are fields in the Cook Inlet that we don't have access to. They're dedicated to LNG, they're dedicated to ammonia urea. And if you take those fields out, what is the volume of gas left for us? And when will that intersection of supply, when will it dip down below demand? And that's this light blue line here. And more concerning is that in 2009, all things staying the same, would not have enough to meet home heating and power generating needs at that point, close to the end of the decade. What is not on the slide here, but is very important to me, as I look at the cost for energy in the rail belt, because there's a later slide that we'll talk about power generation. Cook Inlet gas produces power for 473,000 people in the state of Alaska. They generate power that goes out to Fairbanks. It's a big impact, 473,000. I already mentioned 320,000 residents rely on natural gas from the Cook Inlet for home heating and to heat their businesses. What's not in this information is, what is that cost relative to the alternatives? And if in 2009 or 2010, we had a situation where everybody, all things being the same, everybody had to flip to the next cheapest source of fuel. Natural gas was no longer there. The next cheapest source is fuel oil. And it would represent to our customers a $300 million per year increase in the cost of energy. That's just today. It's two and a half times, it's actually three times the cost. The economic impact to the South Central area would be over $300 million per year. That does not include the increase in cost to generate power, and it does not include the cost to an individual homeowner or business owner to convert to that fuel, which would be another $5,000-$10,000 for an average home. If folks didn't want to use fuel oil and they decided, well, we want to go to propane, that's more than, it's actually more than five times. It would be an additional annual cost to South Central Alaska energy users of over $600 million per year. $500 million. When I think of a number like that, I think of a pipeline that could get me to Fairbanks. Go ahead, John. In terms of usage of cooking light gas, we've got the large user here, LNG, 39%. The gas utility is 18%, uses or moves 18% of what's produced annually to its customers. Power generation, MLMP and Chugach, 16% of what's produced in the cooking light, and then ammonia urea, 27%. Our customers, NSTAR owns 400 miles of high-pressure transmission pipeline. And with that, we serve a lot of folks. We serve the industrial, some of the folks you see listed here, Agrium, Chugach, MLMP, Department of Defense, Northern Eclipse, Fairbanks Natural Gas. These are our industrial customers that we provide transport on the open access system that we own and operate. On the commercial side, it includes hospitals, school districts, malls, state of Alaska, airports, etc. This is the information I mentioned earlier about the number of consumers. When you look at it from a state population perspective, those that are impacted, those that use power or natural gas for home heating from cooking with gas. NSTAR's gas supply. Since we have an impact on a large percentage of the population, what is, somebody could ask, well, how much gas do you have in your contract and where are you at? This is our, we call it the wedge graph, and these are our requirements and how they're going to be met by year. If I were to go to 2005 right here, the different colors represent different producers that are committed to deliver gas to NSTAR's customers. So we have a small amount of gas here in this purple coming from Beluga, Marathon in this teal color, Milwaukee, which is Aurora Power in yellow, and Unocal in green. I started as CEO of NSTAR in 2001, a little bit over 4 years ago. And in 2001, there was none of this green here. This Unocal contract did not exist. And what we were faced with in 2001 was only a couple of short years before we had a significant shortfall. 2005, this new gas represents about 30% of our requirements being met by that new gas, the 150 million or so that Unocal has pumped into E&P to prove up new reserves. The first opening in first open requirements we have are 2009, so as of today I can officially on record say that all of our requirements are met through 2008, and we start to have a gap here. We continue to negotiate with all potential suppliers to try to fill that up. What I can tell you is that it's becoming very, very difficult, much more so than it was in the past, to meet these requirements. In addition, what you don't see represented on any chart is something called deliverability. And it's how do we get, simply put, it's how do we get the gas we need on those coldest of days. If it's 20 below zero, what happens? And because of the decline in the decline in the fields and the cooking light, there just isn't that cushion anymore. There isn't that backup for us. So what we're experiencing now between Chugach and MLMP and NSTAR is if a compressor goes down on the producer, if we have a severely cold day, we are really scrambling to make sure that we're generating the power and getting the gas to the homes that rely on it. Our supply strategy is contract for additional supply. We know we've moved from an excess supply to a supply and demand market. That's really changed how we have to negotiate for supply. To identify and evaluate options to meet future demands. We have achieved some federal support for in-depth DOE study. I referenced that already. It was completed last summer. The observations from the DOE were categorized in three areas. It was reserves growth in Cook Inlet, it was new exploration in the Cook Inlet, or it was gas coming from some source north of us. and I'll review each of those here in a minute. This particular is another from a recent survey that we did. And like the audience, I can't read it from here. But what this one is saying is that the public perception is that a long-term solution to gas in Cook Inlet or in the South Central region is a spur line. Over almost 65% in yellow here are answering the question that should we have a spur line or should we explore in the Cook Inlet? And 65% are saying, gee, we should go north. In terms of reserves growth, what the DOE found is that, gee, there could be another 1.5 trillion cubic feet, and that might provide gas out through the next decade or so. The concerning part of that is the cost. First of all, it's a roll of the dice. I don't know that it's a guarantee. I don't believe that it is a guarantee. The probability may exist, but it's not a guarantee, and the cost could be almost $500 million to do it. New exploration of Cook Inlet. We've seen information from other sources. The Department of Energy says there could be 13 to 17 trillion cubic feet of recoverable gas. Again, the qualifier at the bottom is that to get to 50% of that, if it's available on land, we're talking $5 to $6 billion. And so again, when I look at costs from where I sit, and I look at source of supply that maybe is there, maybe we found it, but it will be in time, and knowing that those costs have to be recovered somehow, ultimately it's the ratepayer, we have a big maybe on the board here. Maybe it's there, maybe we find it, maybe, but we know that it's going to be $5 to $6 billion to get to half of it. I also know that for $5 or $6 billion, I could probably get pretty far north with a pipeline. And if I did, access North Slope gas, just proven reserves at 35 trillion cubic feet, would serve utility needs for a few hundred years. So I've got $5 or $6 billion, and I could go north and get it over with for generations, or we could continue to cross our fingers. Possible pipeline routes. This map is purely here for reference. I think we've seen quite a bit of this, and we'll just move right past it. North Slope or Nanana Basin gas, we see a spur line costing somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million. This, at this point, is a guesstimate based on our experience. We have recently built pipelines in the Cook Inlet, actually on the Kenai Peninsula. We've done it at a cost of about $520,000 per mile, or north of $500,000 per mile for 12-inch. We've seen producers build the very same size pipe in the very same region and do it for $950,000 per mile. So that's not, I'm not trying to disparage anybody. My point is we think we're pretty good at this. We think we've done it for 40 years. We've worked in these conditions. We don't need to bring engineers in from outside. They understand these conditions in Arctic engineering. Opportunities, of course, are tremendous in terms of in some ways, the negative economic avoidance that could come from folks having to convert or having to switch. Absolutely, I have self-interest in wanting to stay in business as a local distribution company. But the impact of the economy of having to switch to something else in the neighborhood of $300 to $600 million a year is pretty concerning to me.
John?
Like Tony said, I'm Director of Engineering Transmission Operations for NSTAR. Basically take care of whatever it takes to build these pipelines, and what I'm here for is to give you all an insight what it takes to build a medium-sized pipeline. I imagine you've been schooled quite a bit on what it takes to build world-class size pipelines.
No.
Can you hear me all right?
I want to ask Tony a question before we get on the pipeline. Your information shows the natural gas usage that NSTAR uses 18% of what's available. Of that 18%, what percentage is commercial and what percentage residential? Do you have that broken down?
Yes, sir. The breakdown is roughly, we move somewhere in the neighborhood of, last year was a record, 63 billion cubic feet. About half of that, we just transport. It's an open access system like a highway, and so that moves to others. But of that 18%, that is broken down to be about 90% residential, 10% for commercial use. In addition to that 18%, there are other slices of the pie that we're hauling on our system, but it's part of the energy, et cetera.
Thank you.
Thanks. Before you continue, let me just recognize that Senate President Stevens has joined us, and Senator Stedman has joined us, and Representative Seaton has joined us. So please go ahead.
Okay. What I'm going to discuss is what it give you all a concept of what it takes to implement a medium-sized pipeline, and speaking of spur lines from Fairbanks to the Cook Inlet. And what we're involved in right now is a conceptual study. And conceptual study, by our definition, is whatever it takes to get the process moved up to submitting for a right-of-way lease for a right-of-way to the state of Alaska. We have experience in this with building other pipelines, and other pieces go into that. And so we're going to educate, let you folks know what we see as the steps it takes. And basically, on the next page, well, I'll go through the details on this one first. The issues it takes to come up with a route is basically what we call conceptual engineering. This isn't out doing the actual engineering. This is coming up with the factors that come into costing the pipeline, looking at the environmental issues with the different state agencies, what permits are needed, whether they're environmental, archaeological, whatever, federal permits, looking what kind of right-of-way ownership, the issues we have to deal with out there on a pipeline coming down from Fairbanks on the Parks Highway route. There's a number of different right-of-ways we can take, whether it's the railroad, the highway, already established corridors where the power lines are. And also in the conceptual study is what socioeconomic issues there may be out there. Now the timeline, and this is important to look at from all the presentations you've seen here, because I kind of see these, even though we haven't coordinated, they all kind of click to the same date out there, 2009. And this is basically what we see as a timeline. If you want to build a spur line from Fairbanks down to the Cook Inlet, when we would have to start it and when we would be ready to move gas. And basically, what I mentioned before, the issues of the conceptual study, again, that's the issues that need to be addressed before we're ready to apply for a right-of-way lease with the state. That takes 18 months. Following that is, at that time, when we submit to the state, we'll be doing engineering and actual permitting with the different agencies. That's basically what happens during this processing time with the right-of-way lease. After engineering, permitting, and concurrent in some ways, we order equipment, look at putting together the construction contracts, and start the construction process, which takes, in our estimate, 2 years on this pipeline. Near the end of this, or during the construction process, would be the RCA review list to determine tariff issues, and all these factors would be discussed with the regulatory agencies all through the process. So that's what I am trying to detail out here, is basically if you started this year and went through a fairly aggressive timeline, given all the other factors, such as the Nanana Basin gas being available out in 2009, and also in the graphs that Tony pointed out, when gas is needed to the Cook Inlet. 2009 is not an unrealistic date to look at for needing a supply, and the time to start doing the study work is right now. We get a deal with the state agencies all the time, and since you guys are down here legislating, maybe I'd like to show you what we go through sometimes. Anyway, there's different agencies we'd go through, archaeological impact, basically the environmental groups such as the DEC, the DNR, their right-of-way issues, EPA, Corps engineers. All these factors go into determining what type of lease we get and what kind of considerations need to go into the engineering. In a recent survey we took on the public's views of the pipeline coming down from Fairbanks, there was a survey that came up with 85% favor a pipeline coming down from Fairbanks on with the spur line concept. So what is NSTAR doing? Like I mentioned, we're into the conceptual study process right now. We're partnering with Department of Energy, MLMP, Chugach Electric, ANGDA, and any of the other concerned parties, which are basically the other state agencies that will determine what type of lease we would get for the right-of-way. We're looking at the basically mix of energy supply options to ensure continued economic growth to Alaska, and that is, as we discussed, Cook Inlet has a finite supply of gas. There's availability, we all hope, of what can come down from the Nanana Basin and how this ties into the North Slope gas. So all those will mix into our goal here to determine where our gas supply is going to come for the future. Along with this, and something that you've got to keep in mind as you talk about pipelines to the Cook Inlet, temperatures vary in Alaska, and so does our swing in our demand. So a pipeline size for what could be summer, it would be very different in the winter, and that's why even right now we're looking at storage options. And to optimally size pipelines in the future, we need to continue looking at storage options. In other words, fill the reservoirs when you can, use them up when it's colder. In the last detail, what we're doing today, we're looking at providing a detailed conceptual analysis to define the costs and benefits of the spur pipeline between Alaska and Fairbanks.
In terms of closing remarks, I'd like to make a few. We are very excited about the potential for development in the Nanana Basin. We see it. We've seen the same information that was presented today, and there's reason to be excited about it because it does represent the potential for some very good news. We like it for some obvious reasons, because we see the decline in reserves in the Cook Inlet and the potential for that providing longer-term energy supply in the region. As a result of wanting to continue to be proactive, I want to reinforce some of the bullets in the presentation, in that we are actively working on conceptual analysis of the routes that you've heard mentioned. Right of way, a combination of railroad, the highway, the power intertie. We're working with the other entities that have been mentioned, the power generators in South Central. We, back of the envelope, know that this is something that's going to be in the scale of maybe a 24-inch pipeline with the potential of compression for future growth. This is in the planning horizon. That's what's exciting about it to us. It's close. The last time NSTAR built the pipeline the longest pipeline built was a 100-mile, 20-inch line built in 1985. We built a lot of smaller ones since then, but this is certainly something that with our 400 miles and the number of years we've been operating on, and it's in this region, we feel pretty comfortable with. We're not saying we're going to be the ones to own it or operate it, but we are proactively working to be prepared. It's like building a house. You don't wait till the framing is up to pull out the yellow pages and find a plumber. You already know what that's going to cost, where the various outlets are going to be, and it comes right in after that. And that's how we look at the future of supply. We want to be prepared.
Thank you, Tony. Senator Seekins?
Thank you. Question I have, when I look at your chart on the Cook Inlet gas supply, if we say, okay, we're going to go get this gas supply from Cook Inlet, either from the Quitter Bay, or we find out that there's a big deposit of gas in the Nanana Basin. And I see this precipitous decline here between 2006 and 2009 that looks like about somewhere in the vicinity of 20 to 25 billion cubic feet per year. The minute that that is declared as the plan for being able to supply the market, there's, why would anybody do any exploration, any further exploration in Cook Inlet when you're talking about the cost there? And how will you make up for the deficit in the meantime?
First, through the chair, Senator, we have to operate any days of gas for any place other than the Cook Inlet. So we're always almost, well, at least we're working with the producers that operate in that region on how to meet that future demand. And we've been very proactive and proponents of development-type contracts because we would rather, if given the choice of no gas or more expensive gas, we take the more expensive gas. The concern that you raise, I think, is a very valid and logical one. It's something that we ponder. It first came to our attention when the push potential for more SoCast development came along, and we realized that with 35 trillion cubic feet of proven reserves on the slope, it could take care of power generating home heating needs for our population for a few hundred years. So we thought, gee, what is that going to do to business? The E&P activity on the Kenai Peninsula, as we look at miles in the country and my experience over 25 years in business, I have to believe that if there is local supply available, there will always be an opening in the market. Our business is to bring the lowest cost dependable energy to the consumer. So should a situation arise where an Nanana Basin gas is developed, a pipeline is coming, yes, we're going to be very excited about it. But I don't believe that our plan would be to ever fill up 100% of our requirements. We've always layered, and if we go a couple of slides down, it's this page, John. Keep going. This one here, the way we work our contract, Senator, is that, for instance, there's step downs. So here's the Beluga contract. If I were to go back a number of years, you would see that it provided more of the gas. Marathon now is beginning to really step down rapidly. Unocal will step down rapidly. And so as we plan in the future, diversification of that supply for a utility is very important to provide continuous, reliable service. It's the old adage, putting too many eggs in one basket. If we were to rely 100% on, say, one pipeline that came in from down the highway, and a contractor some natural disaster caused a problem there, natural gas service is not like power, where if you have a power outage, the transformer gets fixed and the lights get flipped back on. If natural gas service goes out, we would probably freeze South Central. It could take months because of the federal requirements to purge the system, shut every single meter that's affected one by one, document that, pressure, retest the system in sections, reintroduce gas, purge the air out of the system or water if it's required to be hydro tested for pipelines, and then go back home by home and relight it. It would be a catastrophe. So currently today, having the two twin pipelines come up from the Kenai, having the Beluga pipeline, having that redundancy is very good. This is a very unique market. Lower 48, you can be a gas utility and have five or six different interstate pipelines coming from all over the country. And if one goes down, you push a button and they open up a valve across town and just take new gas from somebody else. Here, we are a remote, unusual market. I'm sorry for going on.
My concern is, if I had a drilling rig, I knew you guys were going to go to a long-term, very stable source, and I knew that my cost of exploration and production was going to be high, I'd go somewhere else with it. And I'm just wondering if that isn't one more factor that we'll face. You'll have those dwindling supplies for a while. Will they last long enough? Will their Will you become single source dependent down the road as a result?
We may.
Basically, kind of look at this supply and demand curve, and you have two markets, okay? Even though we may be tied into North Slope, let's just pay the price of gas, and maybe call it $5. I'd like that in 10 years, $5 gas for the Star's customers. At that time, that price will be available to the EMP and we have had them for the years before that. Right now, our new contract gas is $5. I don't see that dwindling down. That'll keep going up, and that'll keep the supply and demand moving, and the supply is ready to go up. But it will finally go up. It cannot go up past what the reserves are. So kind of look at your supply-demand curve and the price.
In addition, Senator, all of the contracts for gas supply must pass approval with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. The aspects, components of those contracts are scrutinized very much. I do think that you have a very good point. I think it is very possible we could be faced with a situation where we fill up requirements so long that it could be a disincentive for folks to go forward with activity. I'm not really sure what the answer is, but I do believe that market forces along the legislation will have an impact.
On your section, the green section, it shows Unocal supplies. Does the contract that they have with Agrin that ends the end of October? Gas currently dedicated to Agrin's operation?
No, Senator. The gas that is committed there is in addition to whatever we might have left or had dedicated to Agrium. Our discussions with UNICAL at this point is that whatever is remaining will have to be recertified because it's in our interest to determine if there is the potential for leftover gas or supply. We have not been able to further that discussion because of the requirement to recertify what might be left over.
Tony, you touched on a figure of $500,000 a mile to build a pipe. What would be the cost if you had to use real rough figures, you know, in the way that they throw numbers at building a pipe to Chicago? What would be the cost of building 50 miles of transmission line to Fairbanks or some pipe down to Cook Inlet? Or where would you connect on your way down to Cook Inlet? Would you connect in the Mat-Su? How would the pipes go, both the spur to Fairbanks and the spur to Cook Inlet?
Sure. Our existing transmission infrastructure goes through Wasilla and Palmer, and so depending on which way it came, whether it was from Glen Allen or from Fairbanks, it would connect in either Palmer or Wasilla. The cost of most recent transmission installations were on the Kenai Peninsula for 12-inch transmission line, the Kenai Kachemak pipeline. In terms of what it would cost for 24-inch along the highway to Fairbanks is really what we expect to answer by the conceptual study that we've started. I'll defer also to John. He may have more specific.
A couple issues to address there is if you picture Fairbanks and the Nevada Basin and Anchorage, of course, quite possibly the right size of a pipeline from the Nevada Basin to Fairbanks, you know, from a short-term viewpoint, right on the 12-inch line, and maybe you could build it up in that area for, depends who builds it, of course, somewhere maybe $700,000-$800,000 a mile, maybe it'll be $1 million a mile, depends on how built. From a long-term perspective, in that gas may only come, given gas has found decent reserves up in the Nana Basin, and there's no North Slope in the picture. Quite possibly it would just be a 24-inch line coming down from the Nana Basin to Anchorage. More than likely, we want to look for the future and look at this as being a 100-year pipeline, kind of matching what the reserves are on the North Slope. And basically, think of a 24-inch pipeline coming from Fairbanks down, which would be somewhat oversized initially if gas is basically coming from the basin up to Fairbanks, but looking at the big picture and supplying the Cook Inlet in year 2020, 2030, 2040. So it'd be a 24-inch line, which basically free flows adequate to cover NSTAR and power needs, can go ahead and add some industrial users. Rough cost on that, probably plus or minus 20%, is about $1.5 million is what we figured in 2 years ago. So that give you a kind of a perspective.
What kind of demand would you have in Fairbanks for gas use to justify building a transmission line from Nenana to Fairbanks?
I think we, in former presentations or earlier presentations, that I believe it was Mr. Mason that talked about the variables of a project, positive variables including the market and access to those markets. Fairbanks represents a potential natural gas market, including all the power generation in Fairbanks. So these are big assumptions, of course, but the full potential for Fairbanks would be 27 billion cubic feet per year is what we estimate. 9 BCF would be residential and commercial. The other 18 billion cubic feet per year would be, again, if all power generation, including military power generation, were natural gas. 27 billion cubic feet a year, just to give you some context, is what NSTAR's customers use for residential and commercial home heating. So in one sense, you can say Fairbanks, that market is as big as at least the NSTAR market is in South Central. So that's the potential. And from there, it would really have to be modeled in terms of what the expected build-out would be, growth, and return on that investment. It would be prospective to begin with. But from what we've seen, and the difference in the cost of energy, realize even with high increases in natural gas, in South Central over the last 2 years, 2004 it went up 14%, 2005 17%, even with those, we are 2.5 times less fuel oil and one-fifth the cost of propane right now.
If you could stay up here, and I want to ask you a question, but Dan Britton, I think, is here. If he could come up and talk a little bit about what kind of infrastructure exists in Fairbanks. I assume that you would build a transmission line from the Nana to Fairbanks first, and then would follow with a... No?
Well, I'm not
just How would you go about it? Where would the economics point you? Which direction would the economy scale point you?
I'll turn the mic over to Mr. Britton, but from my perspective, you would go to the closest place you could sell it the fastest, and that's Fairbanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Britton. I'm the president of Fairbanks Natural Gas and Northern Eclipse LLC. Just to give you a quick background of what we do, we have a liquid natural gas facility in Point McKenzie where we take gas out of the Cook Inlet, liquefy it, and then truck it to Fairbanks for heating market in Fairbanks. We have began serving customers in our first customers in 1998 and started the process of building the plant a couple of years before that. We have now expanded the market in Fairbanks to about 0.6 BCF a year, and we have a little over 700 customers. So we continue to see strong growth in our market. What was your question?
What would we have to build transmission lines in Fairbanks? You know, and Tony's talked about 27 BCF per year, and you're saying we're at 0.6 BCF. And you know, Senator Segan, one of the misconceptions I think that exists in the interior is that we get a gas line, and boom, suddenly everybody's converting to natural gas. And Fairbanks is a diesel, is a home heating fuel driven economy. Can you go through how we would convert a community to natural gas? What would be involved in building transmission lines, and how much would we be able to bring the usage up? Because I'd like to figure out what it would require on the Fairbanks side, you know, for Andex to drill a hole to be able to, you know, they don't want to just create stranded gas in Indiana that they don't have a market for, and stop that.
Well, since we've started in 1998, the challenge that we've had is to compete with the other markets in Fairbanks, and that is fuel oil. As gas prices prices increase, that challenge gets greater. We have historically maintained a price advantage to heating oil, and as such, our customers will save money when they convert to gas. Natural gas has many other attributes to it that make it a desired heating source for residential and commercial customers. It's cleaner. You do not have to have a buried fuel oil tank. You can use it for cooking. You can have a fireplace. It's the really the fuel of choice for a residential and commercial user. Given the fact that right now we, Fairbanks Natural Gas and Northern Eclipse, takes the gas itself, liquefies it, puts it in a truck, trucks it to Fairbanks, stores it, reheats it, and then puts it in our distribution system, we have an extensive additional cost that really will go away when a pipeline is built. If we can increase our competitiveness to the alternative, which is fuel oil, the main alternative, we can increase the conversion rate of customers. So we project that we will see probably an 85% conversion rate of customers within the Fairbanks area. And you know, we see about somewhere around an 8 BCF residential and commercial heating load.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, early in my career, I was on the East Coast following the lifting of the moratorium on expansion of natural gas systems, and we were fuel oil, et cetera, and so it was at the tail end of the 70s. There was an explosion in growth. We were adding 17,000 to 18,000 customers per year. Our NSTAR's analysis of the Fairbanks market in terms of numbers represents about 15,000 or so. Is that? But our estimation is it's about 15,000, might be 16,000, plus or minus a few. From my company's perspective, it would be a 2-year build-up. We'd have the core could be done within 2 years, and access to the majority of the dense areas in that region. A lot of it really depends on how much capital you want to throw at it and the resources you have available. But again, I just wanted to make the comment that I view it as a 2-year. Once it's available, it's 2 years, and it's going to be pretty much anywhere that economically makes sense.
Meaning that you'd build pipe infrastructure in Fairbanks to make it possible to do conversions in the home?
That's how we've approached expansion in our community. We approached it in other parts of the country in this business. Is designed for full build-out, and you start with a skeleton and outline, and you just attack it from there. Again, like the sooner you can get that money to spend, the sooner you're going to get a return on your investment. And
so, if it was a $50 million pipe from the Nenana Basin to Fairbanks before you built the transmission lines to residential and commercial users, how much gas would have to go through that pipe, so that the tariff would be unbearable to put it through there? You've got to increase demand from basically 0.6 BCF a year is pretty close to zero compared to ultimately reaching 8 or 9 BCF for residential users. How would we be able to gauge that expense? Does your study that you're doing, your conceptual study, take into account how that would work?
It would at the once the study were mature, we would have some assumptions on rate of return and what that capital expenditure would be, what an expected rate of return would be, and therefore what would a tariff be that might be acceptable or approved by the state. There are so many factors, it's a very difficult question for me to answer, but it's not a difficult one for us to solve. It's just difficult for sitting here right now in the back of my hand to sketch it out.
And what about a pipe to Cook Inlet? How many miles would that be down to? Would you connect to Mat-Su? Would it be a 200-mile run? Or with the right-of-ways that exist between rail, the highway, and power lines, are the right-of-ways there? Do you have to go through Canal Park? Are there any particular prickly concerns in building pipe from the basin down to Cook Inlet as a possible supply?
Oh, there's a lot of prickly problems in that. There are the various right-of-ways that we have looked at, and with the conceptual study we're taking part in now and we're going to continue with, is looking at each one of these different routes, whether it's, again, the railroad, the highway right-of-way, the power line right-of-way. The line will be a little more than 300 miles long, and like we said, we'd sized it out at 24-inch, operate 1,400 PSI.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just just like to expand a little bit and put in context the growth profile in Fairbanks. Right now, for every mile of distribution main we build, we also have to build the coinciding LNG infrastructure to support that. We are spending more dollars on LNG infrastructure than we are on distribution mains to serve the customer. When that LNG infrastructure need goes away, we can increase our focus on the distribution. Our market growth has been limited by our ability to supply. Given an unrestricted supply, our ability to market would increase significantly. So that getting from the 0.6 BCF to the 8 is not something that we believe is a significant challenge.
Thank you. Senator Bundy has joined us. So what's the chicken and what's the egg here? Does Andex need to produce the gas first? And how would a joining effect happen between you as the folks who would put in the pipe and Andex going on Yuba Valley, Arctic Slope as the doing the exploration? How do we connect those two points?
Well, for Fairbanks Natural Gas, we're going to continue to expand our system with an LNG supply. We're currently looking at options for expansion of our production today. We will continue to expand the backbone of the distribution system in Fairbanks. We have about 50 miles of main in place. We really have, as Tony talked about, the backbone, and are poised and ready to have the fingers come off of that. So we are ready for a gas supply at any time. So.
Tony, can you answer the same question just so we can understand? When we talk about North Slope gas, it's always the issue of the availability of the gas, and if it's TransCanada or something, how do you put together the producer with the people that have the pipe? How does it work if it's a friendly relationship rather than an adversarial one that would exist between Andex, Doyle, and Yuba Valley, and NSTAR and then FMG?
I think all of the parties have certainly communicated at some point or another. The process, how it's worked for us, has been that once there is identified something to sell, we would enter into some type of negotiation on supply. And those agreements can include all types of aspects, including pipeline construction. Our current contract, recently approved to serve Homer, for instance, is a contract that says that the producer must produce X amount, proven reserves, third-party engineer, and if they do that, then there are terms defined and approved by which one company is required to build a pipeline to Homer, and a tariff set by, and a rate set by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. So the supply agreement, as well as that tariff, is that structure is set up in advance. In a situation like this, I would anticipate something similar occurring in a friendly situation. I do believe that a very key point was identified earlier, and it is going to depend on how much gas is there. I really do hope it's a two-inch problem.
If I could ask you, with the time that we have left, and maybe Bob Mason or Tom Dodge can come up and join us, what can the legislature do? How can we help facilitate this process?
Mr. Chairman, can I take a shot at that? Just for one part from my company's perspective, but I think it's very important to hear from the others you mentioned. If we were to bring back that timeline and we showed all the various permitting agencies, whether it be archaeological, whether it be the RCA approval, the number one thing the legislature could do would be to assist us with accelerating that process. That represents, from the transmission pipeline construction aspect side of it, the most significant risk and concern. The timelines that you see there, we put in 12 months for the RCA, we put in some various things. These are what we would hope them to be and believe they could be done, but they're extremely optimistic.
KKPL as opposed to child how it worked.
Yeah, I'm for, I think it, how would you like to use poster child examples of things, and basically there is a dream in Unicalon Marathon's head, about 4 years ago, and at that time they didn't know if they'd find any gas in the lower Kenai. They came to us and asked us about building a pipeline, maybe paying for the pipeline, owning the pipeline, but we can't absorb that risk. We're not a risk taker, the E&P folks are. So basically, a process was set to go ahead and start with the conceptual study work before the wells were drilled, and as soon as the production was proven out, construction began. And that's where in the timeline up here, basically if the conceptual study can move on at this time, you're not taking up 2 years later working out the conceptual study and the permitting issues. And that's where you guys can come in and help out with the conceptual process now, so that doesn't happen after gas is found.
Yeah, there's a couple of issues from Andex's standpoint that are pretty important. I mean, number one, I mentioned in my presentation that depending on the results of our exploratory project, we'd move into a development phase. Well, that all depends on results of well testing, the engineering that we get from that, and that's when we would be talking with the pipeline people about the reserves that we think that we've got. So that's all contingent on well performance. So that's all going to be coordinated. And again, it depends entirely on the results of what we see. If we think we've got something, then in order for these guys to step in and say, okay, we think you've got sufficient reserves, we can give you this kind of deliverability, that sort of thing, that's when you move into that phase where you start negotiating the building of a pipeline. From a legislative standpoint, going back to the exploration phase that we're in right now, where we're still very, very much in that high-risk part of the project, probably one of the most important things that's facing us right now, with the very shortened time Tom had mentioned, that we've got about 2 to 2.5 months, 8 to 10 weeks out of the year where we can actually operate in the Nanana Basin. One of our big concerns right now is being able to take advantage of the tax incentive program that's currently in place. And one of the things that we've talked about is possibly getting those tax credits extended such that we make sure that we can utilize them in the exploration phase. You know, that's one of the most important things that we see on the exploration side. And, you know, beyond that, I can tell you that working with the various and sundry agencies in the DNR and all that sort of thing, Alaska has got, and for good reason, Alaska has got a lot of rules and regs that are in place. And we make sure that we follow all of those rules and regs. And the DNR has been very, very good at helping us in the planning stage and that sort of thing. We don't see any hurdles from that we can't overcome from that phase. Tom, is there anything that you'd like to add?
From an initial standpoint, getting to our upcoming year's hoped for activity level, is we're going to have a quick response time on permits. We have to commit to drilling rigs, to have them available at the end of December, 1st of January, to move into the area to drill. We can't do that if we don't have approved permits. Andex has aggressively attacked the exploration in this basin. Once we had our partnership put together with our group, we had the seismic crew in the field acquiring seismic data the next week. We just finished that data acquiring process last week. We hope to be in the permitting process sometime in the next couple of months with firm locations picked, hopefully no later than June. But before I can commit to a drilling rig and the associated equipment and contractors that are going to have to be required to get these wells drilled, we're going to have approved permits August, October at the latest. And we hope to work with the state and satisfy all the different departments in the state. But what we can't afford is for someone to drop the ball and just do nothing on our applications for a couple of months. If we don't get that done, then we're delayed one additional year before we can drill any wells. And that additional year is going to mean increased cost of drilling. We've seen our cost of drilling go up approximately 50% in the last 12 months in the southern part of the United States. We have steel prices have increased 50 to 75%. Pipe prices have gone up the same proportion. Commodities for exploration and drilling work in general have increased significantly in the last year, primarily driven by the current price of oil and natural gas and the development work that's going on mature fields around the country. Because of our shortened time frame we have to conduct operations, if we don't get permits approved and everybody satisfied that things are safe in a timely manner, we lose another year. And there's a potential, and we will hope to work this with the state. Our area is very wet on the northern half of the license area, and it tends to be a little drier area into the south. The two old wells that were drilled just outside the basin proper were actually drilled in late summer and fall. And there's a potential chance that we may be able to get the state, depending on where our projects are located, to allow for drilling other than in January, February, first part of March. That would greatly assist our operations.
Senator Wagner and Mr. Beadle, could you pop up here and tell us how this would affect the potential of the university? Go ahead, Senator Wagner.
I was going to just, Sean's back there and he can just nod, but I assume in the permitting process, Sean, we aren't going to have people that take extended vacations and let these things sit on their desk. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Sean Parnell, Deputy Director, Division of Oil and Gas. I just wanted to thank the previous speaker for indicating that DNR has not caused any holdups up to this point. I do appreciate that, and we're certainly willing to work with any company that is experiencing some difficulty, so thanks.
And I didn't mean to imply that we've had it.
No, I know. I was just
a short time period to get everything done.
Sometimes that does happen, you know, somebody inadvertently has to leave or something and nobody's charting the process. As long as the process is charted and calendared, then it picks up by somebody else. That's all I was making the point of.
Joe, you and I have talked on the telephone and we've gone over some of the other players. Would you mind just sharing for the benefit of the committee what the University of Alaska's relationship is this project as it relates to the land transfer, and then also as somebody who may join in the speculation, what kind of income opportunity it presents, because we're always concerned about the University of Alaska, particularly here recently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Beadle. I'm Vice President for Finance with the University of Alaska System Office. It is, in fact, very exciting to be at the beginning of something with such a high potential as the Nenana Basin. In addition to the university's interest in education and research associated with the Nenana Basin, we consume several million dollars worth of energy resources each year, and a potential supply such as the Nenana Basin gas is very exciting to us. We're currently in negotiations to convert, emphasis added, our diesel boilers. We receive supplies from coal from Musaveli Coal, and we're very appreciative of their supply of that energy source. Second, as a land-grant university, we are awaiting the outcome of House Bill 130, introduced by the governor and recently passed out of the House Resource Committee. Thank you very much for those of you that assisted us in that passage to the House Finance Committee. If successful, the bill would transfer 250,000 acres to the University of Alaska. The most exciting single parcel is the 90,000 acres in the Nenana Basin, which represents approximately 20% of the licensed acreage area, or about one-fifth of that area. The University of Alaska would own the subsurface and surface estate and be entitled to the 12.5% or 1/8 royalty associated with the appropriate acres of land under license. UA is very pleased that the land transfer bill included the Nenana Basin, and we appreciate the support of the governor's office, the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and all of the staff of the Department of Natural Resources, and now your legislative support in approving that specific bill. We look forward, along with the other landowners in the Nenana Basin, in working with the developers and downstream participants on this project. We appreciate the legislative interest in the Nenana Basin and in supporting the university land transfer bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for any of our folks, Jim? I just want to thank everybody for. I just want to thank everybody for coming and sitting with us for the last couple hours. I think it's a fascinating project that all the parts and pieces are there, and we just wish. Folks from Andex, welcome to Alaska. We hope you have great luck, and the Yusuf Valley family has been in the energy business and keeping Alaskans warm and our lights on for many generations. So thank you and the commitment from Doyon and Arctic Slope and the conceptual study by NSTAR. And it's really a terrific opportunity we may be sitting on that could change some of the significant variables as to how we can get gas to some of the major urban centers in the state of Alaska. So just thank you everybody for coming, and thank Senator Wagner for himself. And
I just want to close in saying that we plan to continue anyway for the next year and a half, continue these types of joint meetings, so we aren't asking you folks to come down here two times to make presentations to both the Senate and the House committees. It seems to be working pretty well, and it seems to save us all a lot of time. So we'll continue that process also.
Chair Samuels or Chairman Corning, do you have anything to close or add?
Thank you. On behalf of the Oil and Gas Committee for including us with this, and to basically reiterate your comments as far as welcoming Andex to Alaska and thanking them for their interest in this state, and we appreciate the risk that they're assuming and the investment that they're making in Alaska. So we wish them the best of luck as well, and we as an oil and gas community are here to help facilitate their operations the best we can legislatively if there's any need to come along. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It was our pleasure. Thank you very much. That's in Wagner. Go ahead and close our meeting. I'd be very grateful. Pull out that
Get my gavel out. Meeting adjourned.